V for Vendetta, novelization by Steve Moore, continued. Disc 7. 20. Unaware of the surveillance van a little way down the street, or of the man already prowling on his roof and looking for a way to descend, Peter Creedy concluded his nightly ritual, standing there in the atrium of his luxurious Hampstead home. Beneath the skylight, where a shadow flitted briefly in the moonlight, unseen, he was feeding nutrients to his collection of orchids with a syringe. The orchids that were his one pleasure, his one relaxation, his only interest apart from the ruthless pursuit of his career and its ultimate goal. The goal he never discussed with anyone. The fantastically shaped flowers, with their beautiful colours, were a major attraction, but more symbolically important to Creedy was the way that, while not exactly parasitic, they naturally grew on other plants. Riding on their backs, the same as he was riding on the back of Sutler, working and waiting for the right day, the right opportunity. And then... Besides, he smiled to himself, the name Orchid derived from the Greek for testicle, and there was one thing he was absolutely sure of, he had far more balls than Sutler ever did. He didn't get to spend enough time here any more. In the past he'd usually been able to pass an hour or so in the atrium before retiring, listening to Wagner or to Richard Strauss, savouring a glass or two of Calvados, reading Nietzsche or Hitler, and communing with his flowers. Some of those flowers he'd paid the earth for, one he'd even killed its owner to obtain. Now, with all this terrorist shit going down, all he had time to do was feed them before collapsing exhausted into bed. Well, soon, no doubt. Turning away toward the door, he flicked off the light, then turned back for a last, almost fond look at those vaguely luminescent petals glowing beneath the moon, and saw another pale shape emerge from among the shadows. The mask of the terrorist. Before Creedy could react, V was upon him, and one of his long deadly knives lay glinting by Creedy's throat, and all Creedy's combat training, all those times when he'd had the gun in his hand and the victim had had no other option but to die helplessly before him, all that added up to absolutely nothing, when the blade was pressing home with uncomfortable firmness against his suddenly throbbing jugular. "Shh," whispered V softly, leading him slowly across to the CD player, knife still poised, and randomly inserting a disc. As the music began to swell, the two men in the surveillance truck looked at each other in bewilderment. Not earmen, these, but Finch's ordinary coppers, yet baffled nonetheless. When they'd seen the light go out, they'd expected nothing but silence to follow, and sleep, and a chance to go off watch themselves. Not music. They'd been on this stint for a couple of weeks now, and it had always ended up in silence and sameness before. "What's he doing in the dark there?" one asked. "Creepy Creedy," replied the other. "Not sure I want to know." In spite of that, they both began to listen all the harder. But the music, as was obviously intended, made it impossible to hear anything else. Well, it would have to go down on the routine report, but it hardly seemed to be anything worth raising the roof about. And back inside. "Sutler can no longer trust you, can he, Mr. Creedy?" whispered V, barely audible. "And we both know why. Sutler is the kind of leader that survives only as long as he seems invincible. The instant he looks weak, that he seems exposed, he's vulnerable. And as soon as he is, they'll be on him like dogs. After I destroy Parliament, his only chance will be to offer them someone else, some other piece of meat, and who will that be?" The blade forced Creedy's head back then, as if it were about to slice his throat open like carving a joint of beef. "You, Mr. Creedy!" A pause to let the words sink in. But Creedy only stood there expressionlessly, trying to look round toward the man who held him prisoner, trying to work out if it was worth trying anything, and deciding it was not. "A man as smart as you has probably considered this," V continued calmly, giving a cool assessment of the situation. "A man as smart as you probably has a plan. That plan is the reason Sutler no longer trusts you. It's the reason why you are being watched right now, why there are eyes and ears in every room of this house and a tap on every phone." And now, for the first time, Creedy showed some reaction, one of stunned disbelief. "Rubbish," he said, though in the instant the word was out of his mouth he began to suspect that it might be true. That was something that would have to be checked out, could easily be checked out, if he got out of this particular encounter alive, of course. "A man as smart as you, I think, knows otherwise," V told him, almost as if reading his thoughts, or knowing the thoughts that would logically ensue from what he'd told him. Naturally, he'd get it checked out, but quietly. If it turned out to be true, there was no point in letting Suttler know that he knew. That would only precipitate a crisis. Far better to know and leave your enemy unknowing while still awaiting your opportunity.
"What do you want?" Creedy asked,
not wanting to move his lower jaw with so sharp a knife pressed so close against the soft, defenseless tissues of his throat.
"Suttler," V told him,
his masked face leaning forward over Creedy's shoulder now so he could see the way the man's eyes flashed.
"Come now, Mr. Creedy. You knew this was coming. You knew that one day it would be you or him. That's why Suttler's been kept underground for security purposes. That's why there are several of your men close to Suttler, men that can be counted on. All you need to do is say the word."
"And what do I get out of this deal?" asked Creedy, mind already racing toward the consequences of launching such a coup.
"I should think that would be obvious," remarked V,
confirming exactly what Creedy had been thinking. And then V held up a piece of chalk in his free hand, moving it into Creedy's field of view.
"If you accept, leave an X on your front door."
"And why should I trust you?"
"Because it's the only way you'll ever stop me."
And then, while one hand held the knife to Creedy's jugular vein, the other pressed on his carotid artery, cutting off the flow of blood. A few seconds later, Peter Creedy lost consciousness, and V lowered him gently and completely silently to the floor. Equally silently, he left through the skylight, the same way that he'd come in. The days passed away into weeks, and other cases came and went, and still Finch couldn't let go of the investigation that continued to command his attention. Nor could Dominic come to that, though each was handling different aspects of the affair. Not the terrorist case, not V, though that still took up most of their time, with Suttler always on their backs. The Larkhill story. And they knew that story was intimately connected with the V case, and that was one of the reasons Finch found it so fascinating, so important. It wasn't just a matter of waiting for V to make some sort of mistake. The man was too good for that. They needed to understand the way his mind worked, what made him tick, where he was coming from. That he'd come from Larkhill was obvious, but beyond that, there were all the coincidences, the strange ways that everything seemed to link up. Finch had been reading Arthur Koestler's The Roots of Coincidence, and become fascinated with the way the world seemed to be constructed like a web, where connections were made that somehow surpassed all normal, everyday understanding. And somehow, plucking the strings of that web like a spider king, was V. Or at least, it seemed to be V. But with all these layers of cover-up and obfuscation, of conspiracy and plot, and downright treason, who could say? Treason and plot. And the 5th of November was drawing ever closer, while they seemed no nearer to V at all. For Finch, though, it was William Rookwood on whom the focus lay. Something about the man seemed wrong. Something about his story didn't add up. One of those feelings again. But it kept sending him back to the man's file over and over, trying to put a finger on what it was. He was at it again when Dominic came over to join him and saw the file open once more on his machine.
"We've had Creedy pinned like a butterfly for weeks, and still no word," Dominic said, frustration edging his voice. "What's he waiting for?"
Before Finch could think of an explanation for Rookwood's silence, if there was one, the phone rang. Dominic picked it up and then passed on the call.
"It's for you, Inspector."
"Yeah?" said Finch distractedly, taking the phone, still staring at the monitor.
"Is that Chief Inspector Finch?"
an unfamiliar voice asked in an unexcited, routine tone.
"It is," he said shortly.
"This is Inspector Clark at Southend. We've found him."
"Found who?"
Finch asked uncomprehendingly, though something began to spark his interest. Another of those feelings.
"William Rookwood," said Clark,
a thunderbolt delivered in an offhand voice. Another of those damnable coincidences, when Finch had just been looking at his file.
"The one you've been looking for. I saw your missing person report a few weeks back and thought I'd run it through our John Does. And sure enough, I hooked him. Perfect dental match. He was a floater. A couple of fishermen picked him up. No ID. Never solved. Until now, that is."
"William Rookwood is dead?" asked Finch, uncertainly. "Needing confirmation."
"I'll say so," Clark told him with a small laugh. "For nearly 15 years now."
Putting down the phone with a polite thank you, Finch leapt to his feet and began to pace around the room like an angry animal trapped in a cage. And Dominic, who'd heard enough of the conversation to understand his feelings, could only look up at him and wait for the storm to blow itself out.
"God damn it," Finch growled,
kicking the wastepaper basket and sending it skittering across the floor.
"It was him the whole time. That son of a bitch sat there and spoon-fed me that bullshit, and I ate it up. God damn it!"
Had any of Rookwood's story been true? Parts of it, certainly. But which? Had the St. Mary's virus really been developed at Larkhill? It certainly looked as if it had, what with the shareholders who'd got rich at Viadox having been, like Protheroe and Lilliman, so intimately connected with Larkhill. And even if Delia Surridge's diary remained evasive about the precise nature and results of her work, the amount of guilt she seemed to have been carrying around with her certainly implied that it could have been. But there remained that contradiction. Everything Finch had discovered before about Larkhill suggested that it was a Norse fire camp set up during the Reclamation, processing the sort of undesirables that so many camps dealt with during that enormous, bloodthirsty purge. But if the St. Mary's virus had been developed there, and it was that viral attack that had brought Suttler's Norse Fire Party to power, then that implied that Larkhill had been operating at least a couple of years before then. Could they have got away with something so flagrant? And if they could, didn't that imply the wholehearted collaboration of the previous government? Imply that, actually, Norse Fire's fascism wasn't actually much worse than that of any other political party, Conservative or Labour? Only more overt? Or was there an even broader conspiracy yet, where Norse Fire was only the public face of a plot that had begun with the previous government, the one that Norse Fire had apparently overthrown to abolish the old order and replace it with the new? But that would imply that the whole political system, whether Conservative, Labour or Liberal, had been unutterly corrupt, had probably been so for years, and that even the pre-war elections were as farcical as the ones they had today. That, in the words of an old catchphrase he'd heard in his youth, "Whoever you voted for, the government still got in." And was the anarchism espoused by V, then, the only true political answer? A state without leaders, that had outgrown the need for leaders because it had realized that the whole concept of leaders had become morally and politically bankrupt. Could that actually work? A true democracy, rather than the so-called democracy that the Americans and British had been so eager to spread around the world before the war, which had turned out to be just another shameless euphemism for globalization and imperialism and exploitation, an excuse for interference that had finally led to the ultimate folly of the Sino-American War. Or was even that thought just another bullshit line he'd swallowed down whole from V? And was Creedy in any way responsible for what had happened? Or had V just wanted to distract their attention away from himself, perhaps needing them to pressure Creedy with their surveillance for some nefarious purpose of his own? Could they even trust those tax records they'd found? Or was the preposterous sum being paid to Lilliman a hidden clue that someone was taking the piss with the entire thing? Was there any truth left anywhere, or only versions of the truth? And were those various versions all part of some gigantic web of conspiracies being manipulated for reasons of his own by that devious bastard V? V. V. It all came back to V.
"What do we do now, Inspector?"
asked Dominic, returning Finch's thoughts, almost, to the situation in hand.
We do what we should have been doing all along. We find him.
But detective work still had to be combined with the political, and that meant attending the increasingly fraught cabinet meetings, where Sattler, obviously feeling the strain of his now vulnerable position, could lambaste both their best efforts and their worst. The only surprise to Finch was that he hadn't grown a little toothbrush moustache by now.
"Every day, gentlemen," he was saying now, his implacable eyes gigantic on the screen as they bore down on his underlings. "Every day that brings us closer to November, every day that man remains free, is one more failure. 277 days, gentlemen. 277 failures!"
Creedy leaned forward into the light from the lamp before him, an action that he knew would immediately focus the primary camera on his face, bringing him to the Chancellor's attention.
"Chancellor, we do not have the adequate force to—" "We are being buried beneath the avalanche of your inadequacies, Mr. Creedy," Sattler cut him off, shouting.
"Definitely losing it," thought Creedy, easing himself back into the shadows. "Well then, watch and wait, and let Sattler dig himself into an ever deeper hole."
"Mr. Dascombe," Sattler said next, moving on to his next target. "What we need right now is a clear message to the people of this country. This message must be read in every newspaper, heard on every radio, and seen on every television. This message will resound throughout the entire interlink."
Dascombe nodded, always ready to appear willing, but not prepared to commit himself to anything until he knew exactly what the Chancellor wanted. And now, Sattler continued, in his most Churchillian tones,
"I want this country to realize that we stand on the edge of oblivion. I want every man, woman, and child to understand how close we are to chaos."
And both Creedy and Finch, enemies as they were, knew what was coming next.
"I want everyone to remember why they need us."
Creedy could only nod to himself in the shadows. Exactly as V had predicted, Sattler was starting, if not to look dead in the water, at least to feel the weakness and vulnerability of his position. Well then, not long now. This was more than a job for Dick and June, Roger Dascombe knew, though naturally they'd have to play their part. But they couldn't be on the television 24 hours a day, and round-the-clock broadcasting was obviously what was required here. It was to be a blitz, with a new news flash every couple of hours, and extended bulletins at breakfast, lunch, and dinner times. As for the newspapers, radio, and Interlink, he'd already delegated that to the appropriate editors and writers, the lesser stuff for the lesser beings. Television was the key, he knew, the same as he knew that he was television's key man. And, unlike the previous feel-good broadcasting they'd always specialized in, this was definitely going to be a bad news day, followed by several more. So all across the country, from tenements to middle-class homes, from bars and restaurants to schools and old people's homes, the population began to find themselves inundated. From the seemingly innocuous but slightly worrying, it got steadily worse, became more and more threatening. Scientists attribute this latest water shortage to the lack of rainfall during the last 2 years. Ministry officials expect water coupon prices to rise. That was always the first step. Get people worried about the basic necessities and threaten to hit them in the pocket as well, but phrase it carefully so it doesn't sound as if the government has done anything wrong. And if they look out of their windows and see that it's pouring rain, well, so what? Most people have such short attention spans that if you tell them that it's all down to last month, when it hardly rained at all, they'll believe you, especially if you tell them that it's only now raining in their part of the country, not anywhere else. And then, once you've used natural calamities to get them worried about their standard of living, hit them with all the other terrors that are quite obviously other people's fault, that they'll want the government to take strong measures against, before the country collapses into the same sort of chaos that's prevailing everywhere else in the world. The things caused by terrorists and undesirables, and the biggest bogey of them all, biological weapons and diseases. The sort of threats that will make people demand that the government take off its velvet glove and smash these people flat with its iron fist, just as it did before, the last time this sort of thing happened. It worked well enough before. It ought to work again. Police arrested 9 suspects believed to be responsible for hoarding avian flu vaccines. In the former United States, civil war continues to devastate the Midwest. Outside the quarantine safety zone, a new airborne pathogen has killed 27 people. The authorities have uncovered new evidence linking the terrorist organization called V to the St. Mary's viral attack on London 14 years ago. In her new apartment, Evie Hammond watched that last item, read to camera this time by June herself, and noted how V had now been inflated into a terrorist organization to make the threat seem still more dangerous. And even without the woman's furious blinking, she knew at least that particular news nugget was a downright lie, and suspected that more people than the government expected wouldn't believe a word of it either. She'd seen what was happening on the streets, the things that didn't get into the news bulletins, the spray-painted Vs that kept appearing on walls overnight, sometimes even on the back of government surveillance vehicles. The defaced strength through unity, unity through faith posters that were being anarchically turned into strength through disunity, disunity through fate. The police cars with their unexpectedly flat tires, the knocked-out security cameras and the loudspeakers with their wires cut. They weren't the work of V. That was the work of ordinary Londoners, starting to wake up at last. Running a hand through her short and newly dyed black hair, she could only wonder more and more what the approach of November the 5th would bring. Whatever it was to be, it seemed that Fedco would be delivering it. By train, by truck, by individual delivery man, the immense number of perfectly uniform boxes, with perfectly uniform and perfectly false return addresses, were sent across the land with the same sort of thoroughness that Roger Dascombe achieved with his broadcasts, to rich and poor, to individuals and institutions, and to every single member of Sutler's cabinet. Eric Finch was only half-dressed for work and entirely unshaven when the Fedco man arrived at his door. He merely grunted when the man began to idly chatter about the number of deliveries he was having to make. "Never known anything like it, Gov. What the hell's going on?" Signed for the box and took it within, having only had one cup of coffee and still too bleary-eyed to even wonder what he'd got. Only way to find out was to open it, anyway. He ripped the box open roughly and dumped the contents on the table before him. And a Guy Fawkes mask lay there looking back up at him, a broad grin on its face and seeming all the broader for the message it conveyed. The face of V.
"Bloody hell," said Finch, scratching his head.
What was the evil bastard up to now? Making his way to the office, he was given no clearer idea, though from the amount of torn and discarded Fedco boxes that littered the streets, he was getting some notion of the scale of things. This was beginning to look like the biggest mass mailing Fedco had ever had to deliver. How was he doing it when, despite what the government propaganda machine was saying, the organization called V consisted of one man? Perhaps two if you included the Hammond girl, but she seemed to have dropped off the radar in the last few months. Maybe if they could find her again, it might be a way to get to him. But they couldn't. She'd gone. Maybe the finger had got her and the information hadn't been passed back to Finch. Maybe she was dead. That left just V responsible for the whole thing. Computerization had to be the answer. It was the only way one man could have organized all this, with the ordering of the masks, probably from several different sources to cover his tracks, and the mass mailing through the official delivery system. And if that was it, it meant that V was good enough to hack into the government's own system, putting the trip on the Rookwood file, getting the information on the Larkhill staff who were to become his victims, their whereabouts, their changes of name. No wonder Creedy had been talking about Sutler suspecting an informer within the government. The government's own system had been leaking like a sieve all the time, and no wonder V always seemed to be one step ahead of them. He should have realized it before, but it had taken something of this scale to actually bring it to his attention. He'd get the tech boys on it, naturally, but it was getting so close to November he had a nasty feeling that even if they could shut up shop more effectively, it wouldn't make much difference. V probably had all the information he needed already, and might not ever hack the system again. So probably no chance to put a trace on him that way, either. Clever bastard, thought Finch. Trying to catch the man was giving him nightmares, But the way V operated, the way he had everything planned out, well, Finch had to admire him. Grudgingly, but he hadn't had a challenge like this to get his teeth into for years. It was complete bedlam at New Scotland Yard when he finally arrived. First stop, the coffee dispenser, then into the fray. He hadn't seen the place like this in years.
"How many went out?"
he shouted to Dominic over the cacophony of ringing phones and shouting staff. Someone had got up a feed to the control room, so they were getting in the radio reports from the ordinary bobbies on the beat as well. And every word was about Guy Fawkes masks and Fedco deliveries and V.
"So far we think it's about 8 containers worth," Dominic yelled back at him. "Several hundred thousand, at least!"
"Christ!" was all Finch could say, though he doubted that even the deity could get them out of this mess. Making his way to his desk, he'd barely had time to sit down when the phone rang. Not the normal office line, but that phone. The direct line. With a sense of weary inevitability, Finch picked it up.
"I want anyone caught with one of those masks arrested!"
Sutler immediately screamed in his ear. Finch didn't see any point in trying to explain that in no way did they have enough manpower to arrest what might well total up to be half the inhabitants of London, or anywhere to put them if they did.
"Yes, sir,"
was all there seemed to say, so he did, adding under his breath that timeless phrasing he'd learned as a bobby on the beat in response to impossible orders from above. "Yes, sir, no, sir, 3 bags full, sir." Stupid bastard, Sutler was. Almost as stupid, he was beginning to think, as he'd appeared on that Dietrich's half-hour show, the last one there'd been before they'd had Gordon Dietrich shot. Pity about that. It had been a fairly gross show, but if it had had material to work with like this current situation, it could have given him quite a laugh. And laughs were damnably few and far between these days. As soon as he put the phone down on the Chancellor, it seemed that every other phone in the place began to ring simultaneously. And they just didn't stop, no matter how many of them were answered.
"We're under siege here," Dominic told him, stating the obvious. "The whole bleeding city's gone off its nut."
"That's exactly what he wants," Finch said, a hint of appreciation in his voice for his opponent's skill, for the enormity of his vision. "What his plan needs."
"What?"
asked Dominic, not quite grasping the point.
"Chaos. Absolute fucking bloody chaos!"
And chaos was indeed breaking out all over, and continued to do so in the succeeding days. Not only all over London, but all over the country, for the ownership of one of V's Guy Fawkes masks, and the anonymity it conferred, somehow seemed to liberate large numbers of the population from their repression, and to set free all the yearnings they'd so long suppressed in exchange for law and order, and a society that seemed to work when all the world around them was collapsing. And all that in spite of Roger Dascombe's carefully crafted propaganda to the contrary, which hammered home the message that this was all part of a terrorist plot, and an attempt to overthrow all the gains that they'd made since the war, and the much more heavily emphasized point that wearing or possessing one of the aforesaid masks constituted an act of conspiracy with a terrorist organization that was grounds for immediate arrest. All responsible citizens, the message concluded, would immediately destroy any such masks on sight. And perhaps 1 in 100 of them did. For some of those who didn't, the masks were no more than opportunities for criminality in the name of anarchy, and the following days saw an outbreak of muggings and armed robberies, from minor convenience store heists to daring bank raids. But for most, the masks provided cover for far less obnoxious, though still illegal, acts. For being out after curfew. For fearlessly destroying the CCTV surveillance cameras that stood on every street corner. For slogan painting, from Norse Fire Out through Hang Sutler, and Take Your Finger and Stick It, and Bollocks. Less abusive, but rather more worrying, were the anarchist cries of No Government and No Leaders, for they undercut the very foundations of whatever the political system might do to try to regain control of the situation. But most worrying of all to the Norse Fire establishment was the simple letter V, spray-painted in a circle. And of this last piece of vandalism, an alphabetical designation that V himself would certainly have enjoyed, There seemed to be more and more examples, springing up everywhere, somehow moving ever closer toward Downing Street itself. Even in remote parts of the country where the security clampdown wasn't quite so heavy, the masks gave opportunities for minor demonstrations. Perhaps most insidious and spontaneous of all were the parties being held everywhere. Behind closed doors, for the most part, they were anarchic, masked balls, where anything went from political jokes and satire to the most riotous drunken orgy. And anarchism that's started to enjoy itself is the most difficult movement to suppress of them all. Well aware of the deteriorating situation, Peter Creedy sat at home among his orchids, remembering how Sutler had picked him out at that day's meeting and holding something in his hand, a small object that had become talismanic to him now. Remembering,
"Mr. Creedy, I am holding you personally responsible for this situation,"
as if it were somehow his fault, as if he hadn't shot enough people to fill his quota, as if he and the Finger weren't the last bulwark between Sutler and a restless population, between order and complete collapse. Remembering, too, that V had been quite right. He had been under surveillance. And as the watchers seemed to be ordinary policemen, he had to assume that Finch had arranged this at Sutler's behest. "Who watches the watchman?" Juvenal had asked. And when this particular watchman found out that it was a battered has-been like Eric Finch, well, that was the sort of insult no one should have to put up with. And Creedy's grip grew tighter and tighter around the object in his hand until it cracked with a tiny noise, bringing his thoughts back to his present situation, and back to the piece of chalk that V had given him, now lying in two pieces in his palm. While far away, in a room at the Shadow Gallery, V began to line up a vast row of dominoes on the floor, that wound and curved, came together and parted once again, making the pattern of a V contained in a large circle, which would only need one falling tablet to bring all the others down in succession. The domino effect that would begin when one small event finally tipped the scales, and the whole system lurched over from order to chaos, from rigidity to collapse. Something on a cosmic scale that would be little more than a finger flick, or the flapping of a butterfly's wing, or a dark cloud crossing the face of the moon. 21.
"The problem is that he knows us better than we know ourselves," Finch remarked to Dominic, looking over the piles of reports that grew at an accelerating rate as they approached nearer and nearer to November. And this was only the ordinary police work, the actual felonies and minor public order offences. Creedy's fingermen were supposed to be dealing with the political activists, suppressing the minor demonstrations and riots that occurred almost daily now, from protests against food shortages and heavy-handed police tactics to outright anti-government fervour. The one feel-good factor in the whole situation, Finch thought, was that Creedy was probably even more overworked, more under pressure than he was. But neither of them could quite get a grip on what V was up to, apart from stirring things up and overloading the system with paperwork.
"That's why I went to Larkhill last night," Finch continued matter-of-factly, knowing full well the impact his words would have.
"You what?"
exploded Dominic, only then noticing that Finch had the debugging device switched on. Even so.
"That's outside the quarantine zone," Dominic added,
even though both of them knew it well enough, knew the risks involved in going there.
"I had to see it," Finch said simply,
remembering how, rather than heading directly for home, he'd taken the car and driven, far more slowly and carefully than Dominic ever would, down to Salisbury Plain, arriving there in the twilight glow of a blood-red setting sun. Not that there'd been much left to see. Most of the wire-link perimeter fence had rusted away, or been stolen for scrap metal, and the concrete posts from which it had been strung were leaning, sometimes sagging, broken halfway up, like clawing talons emerging from the earth, or gigantic skeletal fingers of the dead straining up toward the light from the mass graves beneath. Quite apart from any medical research, how many thousands had died there? How many more thousands in other camps like it, scattered round the country, in places like Bradford, Liverpool, or Leicester. Far more, he had no doubt, than in the St. Mary's epidemic. But these were the non-English, non-Christian, non-normal, non-humans, as far as the regime was concerned, whose number, whose names, and even whose memories had just totally been erased. Of course, the government said they'd been deported to their countries of origin. Everyone knew they hadn't. As for the buildings themselves, most had fallen into ruin, and once the roofs had caved in and the walls began to crumble, it was hard to tell what was what. Most, at least, bore evidence of the explosion and fire that had destroyed them, with soot-covered bricks and wooden beams turned now to charcoal. Were these cells or offices? How did one tell the administration block from the medical section? If ever there were signs here, they had long been removed. Even the name, Larkhill, was no longer to be found anywhere about the site. "I barely remembered Pompeii," he thought at first, "destroyed not with a volcanic roar and a burying rain of ash, but with homemade bombs, with fertilizers and incendiaries, by a lone man driven by mental and medical torture into a state Finch couldn't even begin to comprehend." But that wasn't quite what it was. It was more like the shattered remnants of a forgotten necropolis, of fallen mausolea and half-uncovered vaults, of tumbled, lichened gravestones, a remembrance of the dead more poignant in its ruin than such vast official edifices as the St. Mary's Memorial, and a far more fitting testament to those who died, both in the outbreak of the virus and its research and manufacture. For this was not the sanitized, saccharined monument suggesting some happy post-extinction survival. This was raw and decayed and rotten. Just like the whole disgusting business had been from its origins here to its conclusion in London. There was a stench about the place, not of the dead, but of evil and corruption. If this place had ever had anything to do with the St. Mary's virus, of course. If that wasn't just another of those stories. Those illusions made of smoke and mirrors that reduced the entire past to the same sort of chaos that the present seemed to be descending into. But there had been a row of what seemed to be shattered cells, with the fragmentary remains of a ceramic-tiled floor outside them, their metal doors occasionally still hanging on their hinges, most of them with a chalk-marked X still faintly visible, and numbered with Roman numerals. And there was one door where he'd paused for many minutes, deep in contemplation, trying to immerse himself in all that had happened here, all that had led up to it, and all that had followed from it. The door to Room 5. Room V. And that was really the thing he'd come to see. The point of origin. Room V. Prisoner V. The terrorist code-named V, the opponent he'd learned to respect, but whom he still had no idea at all how to deal with. V. That, at least, seemed to be something real. Something he could hang on to. A single iconic fact among the fantasies on which he could try to build some sort of understanding. There wasn't much left, he told Dominic, his mind returning to the present moment and trying to sum up the experience. But when I was there, it was strange. I suddenly had this feeling that everything was connected. It was like I could see the whole thing as one long chain of events that stretched all the way back before Larkhill. I felt like I could see everything that had happened and everything that was going to happen, like a perfect pattern laid out in front of me. And I realized we were all a part of it. And all trapped by it. He fell silent again then, running it all through his head as he had so many times before. The stories. Delia Surridge's diary. The Rookwood tale that he still didn't know to be fact or fiction, or, if a blend of the two, what the proportions were. The tax records. And Lilliman's absurdly high pay at Larkhill, unless that too was a red herring. What if there really had been some legitimate reason for it? It was as if they had pieces from different jigsaw puzzles, which seemed to fit together somehow, although the picture they made persistently refused to make sense. And underlying that were what seemed to be the historical facts. Larkhill had, obviously, been destroyed by fire, whatever had occurred there. The St. Mary's virus was real enough, as were the deaths it caused, no matter who was to blame. Adam Sutler had held all those Norse fire rallies and got himself elected on an anti-terrorist vote. And Peter Creedy was a bastard, no matter what he was or wasn't accused of. And V had blown up the Old Bailey, attacked the Jordan Tower, murdered all the Larkhill staff, would undoubtedly blow up the Houses of Parliament, unless he was somehow stopped beforehand. Had shipped out all those masks and manipulated Finch into watching Creedy, the reasons for both of which he still didn't quite understand. And mingled in with all of this were those inexplicable, infuriating coincidences. Another one had occurred last night, driving back from Larkhill, where he'd seen the faint, chalked X on one of those decaying doors. He'd passed through Hampstead on his way down from the M25, and hadn't been able to stop himself from glancing at the entrance to Peter Creedy's house, and there, on his foe's front door, was another chalk mark X. What the blue bloody hell could that mean? And yet, all part of the pattern, that baffling, infuriating pattern that he knew somehow was being ringmastered by the baffling, infuriating V. Like dominoes waiting to fall. The pattern.
"So, do you know what's going to happen?" Dominic asked him eventually, when the silence had stretched to an almost embarrassing length, as if he hoped that Finch would provide some godlike flash of inspiration, whereby they could write "case solved" under the whole thing and get back to their normal lives.
"No," said Finch, shaking his head and smiling ruefully. "Like I said, it was just a feeling. But I can guess. With all this chaos, someone will do something stupid. And when they do, things will get nasty." By another of those coincidences that V seemed to glory in and that Finch had come to expect, someone had done something stupid at the very moment Finch had been standing there lost in his meditations at Larkhill. For in that same blood-scarlet sunset twilight that tinged the clouds an almost heavenly religious pink, a prowling fingerman had been making his way through a Brixton back street when he'd come across a small girl, about 8 years old. A small girl wearing a mask. If that was all, he'd probably have let it go. After all, the orders to arrest everyone wearing a Guy Fawkes mask were plain enough, but surely one could use some discretion regarding little girls. But the mask wasn't all. She had a can of spray paint in one hand and was standing before one of the almost sacred "Strength Through Unity, Unity Through Faith" posters the party continued to put up everywhere, despite their ever more frequent, ever more infuriating defacement. And she'd just sprayed one of the goddamned V symbols all over it. And he was a party man through and through, who'd been on 12-hour shifts for the last 3 weeks without a break, dealing with one sort of protest after another, from sprayers and curfew breakers to stone-throwers and young tearaways with Molotov cocktails, and this was just the last straw.
"Hey! You!"
he shouted, running toward her. Child or not, this little cow was going to jail. She began to run then, tiny legs pumping, still masked, shrieking in terror. As windows opened and curtains rustled nearby, she threw away the can of spray paint, left it rolling in the road behind her. Rolling beneath the feet of the oncoming fingerman, who, eyes only on his prey, trod on it, lost his balance, and went slamming heavily into a wall. And, as is so often the case, the wall didn't come off worse. Blood ran into his eye from a gash above the brow. His head rang from the force of the impact, and all he could do was gasp as the breath was forced out of his lungs. A savage pain shot through his twisted ankle where he'd trodden on the can, and the gun was in his hand before he even knew it, the trigger pulled before he even thought. One shot was all it needed. One shot to tip an already unstable situation over into a spiralling vortex of ever-increasing uproar. The girl's body jerked in the air as if pulled by a string, the hole blown straight through her tiny lung quite horrific. She hit the ground in an angular, contorted heap, weltering blood, and never moved again. The thin papier-mâché mask, however, already loose on her small, childish head, came off and floated briefly in the air before hitting the ground and rolling on its edge, finally coming to rest at the feet of a startled man holding a monkey wrench,
who'd been fixing his car when the shot rang out. A man who looked down and saw a mask spattered with a young child's blood. Someone's daughter. Not his daughter, but somehow then she was everyone's daughter, as a crowd began to gather, drawn from their houses by the tragedy that had happened before their eyes. Men and women, teenagers and pensioners. Mostly empty-handed, some with the knives they'd been using in their kitchens, dinner almost due, and as the finger man limped up to stand over the body of his victim, a horrified realization finally dawning upon him of what exactly he'd done, they began to close in. They paused when he brandished the gun and showed them his badge, eyeing each other uncertainly as he tried to bluster his way out of the situation, but a low muttering began as the girl's wailing mother forced her way through the crowd and threw herself on her daughter, screaming curses at the murderer. At that point, the car mechanic stepped up behind the finger man and hit him over the head with the monkey wrench. And then the blood really began to flow. Not just in Brixton. Creedy and his finger men thought they'd managed to keep a lid on that one before the riot really got out of hand, even if it did cost them 15 operatives. Mass arrests and an invasive, brutalizing security presence ought to have done it, and they managed to keep it off the airwaves. Yet somehow word of what had happened got out anyway. Not only about the little girl, but about the body count that totaled up in the succeeding hours. Fingermen, after all, didn't let their own go unavenged. But they could do nothing about the second Brixton riot the following morning, or the ones in Manchester, in Bristol, in Newcastle, and in Liverpool. And in New Scotland Yard, where they kept a BTN screen on all the time now for news flashes to give them the bigger picture of what was going on outside the capital, Eric Finch looked toward Dominic and shrugged despondently. It was no longer a case where things will get nasty. They already had. And so, Finch picked up his former train of thought, Sutler will be forced to do the only thing he knows how to do. Dominic knew very well what that was. Call out the army, declare martial law, widespread round-the-clock curfews, rioters and looters shot on sight. At which point all V needs to do is keep his word. And then... Finch left the sentence hanging there. Neither of them wanted to think about the consequences after that, although they had to wonder if they could be all that much worse than what was going on right now. In the shadow gallery, V had long been thinking about the consequences, planning for them, working to make them come about. Now, managing to make the slight flick of a gloved finger into a grandiose gesture of enormous importance, he knocked over the first domino in his grand design, starting at the point of the V, listening in satisfaction to the series of soft, repeated clicking noises, watching as the falling dominoes split into two rows, as the motion raced down the arms of the V, reaching the circle's edge and continued back round the circumference perfectly spaced, perfectly timed, so that the dual lines of falling forms would meet precisely at their starting point with singular inevitability. Two equal and opposite forces crashing together simultaneously and with perfect symmetry. And somehow leaving a single domino still standing. And V could only stare at it, rather as a jeweller would who discovered, at the last moment, a tiny, unique, but compelling flaw in an otherwise perfect design. 22. I sometimes still hear this song in my head when I wake up, Evie Hammond remarked thoughtfully, standing in the shadow gallery by the jukebox, which she'd just set to start. I missed it. She turned away from the machine as the music began to play, looking round at the place she remembered so well for so many different reasons. Some good, some bad. The bad ones seemed so much less important now, and as for the good ones, it had been home for a while, and apart from anything else, it was still an Aladdin's cave, full of wonderful things that she'd come to treasure just as much as he did. She looked fit and strong, confident and at ease, her now black hair grown to about half the length it had been when he'd first brought her here. "I wasn't sure you'd come," V said, standing at the edge of the shadows, still masked, as always, and in the full outfit of cloak and hat besides.
After all, she'd left it until the very evening of the big day.
"I said I would,"
she smiled. Now a promise was something to be kept, not to be backed out of, as had so often been the case in the fretful, fearful days of the past.
"You look very well," he continued, making polite conversation in a way that she hadn't really ever expected from him, unless this was the way in which he handled the tension that must be building up before he began the act that, she knew in her heart, would be the grand finale of all he'd ever worked toward.
"Thank you,"
she said simply. There was no point in returning the compliment to him, when all she could see was a mask. "You've had no difficulties?" he asked her, although the mere fact that she'd come back made it plain that whatever she had had to face, none of it had been insurmountable.
"For a while?"
She smiled again, remembering but not wishing to tell him of her early struggles.
"Then I was able to buy a new ID. The police were after Evie Hammond. No one cares about Anne Campion."
"Your mask," he said, if not exactly with laughter in his voice, at least with a suggestion that beneath the Guy Fawkes mask there might be something of a real smile.
"Of sorts."
"Not uncommon these days," he continued lightly, and both of them knew precisely to what he referred.
"I suppose not,"
she laughed, not really used to hearing him joke. And then a silence fell between them, lengthening as each of them waited for the other to speak next, she because she knew he must have asked her to come back here for some reason of considerable importance, and wanting to give him the opportunity to tell her what it was, he because he wasn't sure she was ready yet to hear it, or if he was ready to tell her. At last the song on the jukebox came to an end, and in the quiet that ensued there seemed no alternative but to go ahead. "I have a gift for you, Evie. It's the reason I wanted to see you again. But—" Another hesitation, then almost shyly, "before I give it to you, I was hoping you might like to dance."
"Now?" she asked, charmed but taken completely by surprise. "On the eve of your revolution?"
"A revolution without dancing is a revolution not worth having." All his body language showed an eagerness to hear her say exactly what she did.
"I'd love to."
Not far away, above ground, Dominic was driving Finch back from Chelsea Barracks, where they'd been for a briefing on the military arrangements that had been put into place for protecting Parliament Square that evening. A few minutes more would bring them to the Houses of Parliament, where protocol demanded their presence, but neither of them wanted to be. Not because they feared death or injury if V did actually blow the place up, but because they knew that if he did, the presence of two extra policemen wasn't going to make the slightest difference. And besides, Chief Inspector Finch was starting to develop one of his feelings again. "Stop here and let me out," he said suddenly, realizing they were passing Victoria Underground Station.
"Come on, Inspector," Dominic protested. "We've got our orders. We've got to do our job."
"That's not my job," Finch told him, as Dominic resignedly brought the car to a halt anyway. "My job is to find him."
"But we've been searching those tunnels for weeks,"
Dominic said, in one last attempt to change Finch's mind. He didn't know where the old man had got his bee in his bonnet from when all the other specialist opinion was that V would attack by air, but he just wouldn't let it go. Apart from the fact that the entire underground system had been closed down since the reclamation, awaiting reconstruction, or, more the point, awaiting enough surplus power to run the thing, everyone knew the Circle, District, and Jubilee lines had deliberately been blocked off for years, and they were the only ones that ran anywhere near the Houses of Parliament. And surely it was far too late, even for last-minute feelings.
"You're not going to find him now,"
Dominic called as Finch got out of the car, but nothing was going to get his boss back now. Well, he thought, shrugging as he watched Finch disappear down the stairs into the station, there seemed to be nothing else for him to do except report to his post and hope he could think of some reasonable excuse for the inspector's absence, before anyone actually asked him for one. Maybe he'd tell them the old man was having a nervous breakdown, or that he'd gone undercover, 30 or 40 feet undercover. At the same time, Dominic had to hope that Finch would be all right, because now he was getting one of those same feelings that his chief seemed to suffer from so often,
a feeling that however things turned out tonight, this was one of those pivotal moments when things change forever. For better or worse, he had no idea, but he knew they'd never be the same again. And suddenly he wondered if he'd ever see Eric Finch again, too. The latter, meanwhile, had passed through the station concourse and was already making his way down the now stationary escalators, with only a flashlight to guide him. Somewhere down beyond the platforms, somewhere down in the tunnels, either on the Victoria Line or, more probably, the Circle and District lines, that had to be where the answer lay. Maybe even on the other side of the blockades, if he could find some sort of maintenance tunnel they'd overlooked before. There was far more to an underground station than the train tunnels and the platforms that were all the general public saw. Maintenance shafts, emergency exit tunnels, underground sidings where trains could be shunted aside to let others pass, a maze of passages. An underground labyrinth where you could still hope to find a Minotaur-like monster such as V, bred from some horrible experiment, if only you had the right clue. And only two London tube stations started with V, Victoria and Vauxhall, and the latter was south of the river, away from the centres of power, away from all the scenes of V's exploits. If it was anywhere, it had to be Victoria. Not far away, the target of Finch's search was dancing slowly with a beautiful woman in his arms. A last dance. The last waltz. Before he brought the world to an end. At least, the world of Sutler's England, long overdue for demolition.
"You've been busy," Evie told him, looking up into his mask, that mask that had been all that she'd ever known of him. "They're very scared right now. I heard Sutler is going to make a public statement tonight."
"It's almost over," V said, and one way or the other she knew that he was right. If not for Sutler's world, for his own.
"The masks were very ingenious," Evie continued, wanting to let him have some idea of her appreciation for the way he'd handled his campaign.
In the past, when her fear had made her betray him, or when he'd been torturing that same fear out of her system, there hadn't been much opportunity for that sort of thing.
"It was very strange to suddenly see your face everywhere."
He replied with one of those Shakespearean quotes of which he was obviously so very, very fond. "Conceal me what I am, and be my aid for such disguise as haply shall become the form of my intent."
Twelfth Night.
She identified the passage easily, never having forgotten the play since she'd acted in it as a child. "Viola," he added, remembering that had been the part she'd played. She gave herself up contentedly once more to the dance. Even so, tonight, on this last night before everything changed, there were still things to say, still questions unanswered. Feminine curiosity, which in spite of everything, wouldn't quite go away.
"I don't understand it," she said eventually.
"What?"
"How you can be, in some ways, one of the most important things that has ever happened to me. And yet I know almost nothing about you. I don't know where you were born, who your parents were, or if you had any brothers or sisters. I don't even know what you really look like."
There was the question, then, hanging on the air, not quite asked, not quite demanding an answer. A bait he could have taken if he'd wanted to, but didn't. "Evie, there is a face beneath this mask, but it isn't me. I'm no more that face than I am the muscles beneath it, or the bones beneath that." Ambiguous to the end, then. Was she to take that as meaning that the face beneath the mask had been destroyed in the same way as his hands? Or was he saying that a man is not the face he presents to the world, the public persona, but something deeper, more intrinsic, a personality that far transcends personal appearance, that the face itself is nothing but a mask? Either way, he could still have the face of a devil or an angel hiding behind that of Guy Fawkes, and finally she decided it was better never to know.
"I understand," she said rather awkwardly,
continuing with the dance.
"Thank you,"
he said quietly.
"You know,"
she said brightly then, changing the subject to something rather safer.
"I found a copy of The Count of Monte Cristo. I think of you every time I watch it. It's funny, though. Now I never feel as sad for Mercedes as I do for the Count."
Finally the music came to an end, and a silence returned, breaking their tenuous moment of intimacy. As he released her from his arms, V seemed to fall back once more into his usual cool, composed self, again as remote from her as he was to the world in general. "There isn't much time left," he began, turning to usher her out of the room, "and I have something that I must give to you." Wondering what on earth he could intend, she let him lead her through the labyrinth that was the shadow gallery, through a number of doors, and then out into a long tubular tunnel, and so finally, descending some stairs, onto a station platform.
"The underground?" said Evie wonderingly. "I thought they closed it all down."
"They did. It took nearly 10 years to clear the tracks, at least as far as I wanted." Only then did Evie really notice the old train standing in the platform. Original rolling stock it may have been, but now it was transformed, the outside painted all over, not with graffiti, as in the old days, but with beautiful Art Nouveau curlicues and arabesques, with lilies and with roses.
"What a beautiful old train," breathed Evie, eyes wide with astonishment, and recognizing V's hand in the decoration.
If trains had always looked like this, she thought, they'd probably never have been vandalized in the first place. And if everything had been made and decorated like this, if whole cities had been designed by Antoni Gaudi instead of the architects who gave us dehumanizing concrete blocks to live in and shopping malls that looked like prisons, perhaps there would never have been a fascist party, or senseless crimes, or wars, or fewer of them anyway. "Let me show you," he said, taking her hand and leading her toward it. But before showing her the interior of the carriage, he took her to the driver's cab. "These trains used to work with what was known as a dead man's handle," he explained, "where the power would only reach the motors if the driver was sitting here holding it pressed down. I've disabled that. There isn't any power here anyway. But there is a slight gradient leading from here down to Westminster toward where the tunnels are still blocked. All you have to do is release the brake handle here, and the train will run away down the track on its own."
"But why are you telling me this, V?"
she asked, confused. "In case you need to know," he told her mysteriously, then led her back toward the carriage. As she'd rather expected, it was filled with Violet Carson roses. But there was more than this besides. The front of the train, just behind the driver's cab, was packed with small rectangles of what seemed to be red clay, wrapped in wax paper, all stacked together in the aisle between the seats to make up a sort of platform, almost like a bier. A glance round revealed more of the little red bricks behind them, and she had to conjecture they were packed in throughout the train.
"What are these?"
Evie asked, picking one of them up. "Gelignite," he said offhandedly.
"What?"
she exclaimed, taken so much by surprise that she almost dropped it. "Careful," he said with the faintest of laughs, as she guardedly but hurriedly put it back in the stack before taking a couple of swift paces backward.
"You said the tracks were blocked down at Westminster," she said thoughtfully, then added, "Under the Houses of Parliament?"
He nodded.
"Then it's really going to happen, isn't it?"
she said slowly. Somehow she'd always known that it would, even though she couldn't imagine how. But to actually be here, seeing it, being part of it, put the whole thing in a new light, all that planning, all that labour, all those years, all leading up to this one night when everything would explode in flame and fury. "It will, if you want it to."
"What?"
she exclaimed. What on earth did it have to do with her? "This is my gift to you, Evie." His hand circled in a gesture that at first, she thought, referred only to the train, although she then realized it was far more all-encompassing than that. "Everything that I have—my home, my books, the gallery, this train. I'm leaving them to you, to do with what you will."
Evie looked at him with an expression almost of disappointment. This wasn't the sort of gift she'd expected. Indeed, she doubted that a train full of gelignite would feature very highly on any girl's wish list, but there was obviously more to it than that. Apart from his possessions, he wanted to pass on something more.
"Is this another trick, V?"
she asked tentatively. "No," he said simply. "No more tricks. No more lies. Only truth. The truth is that you made me understand that I was wrong, that the choice to pull that lever is not mine to make." A few moments to mull things over, and then she thought she understood. After all, if it had been merely his choice, all this would have been reduced to little more than an act of personal vengeance taken against the people who'd made him what he was. The act, as she'd pointed out to him before she'd left, of a monster paying back the people who'd made him what he was. And the role of monster was obviously one that, in the end, he'd decided to abdicate. Even so, she wanted to hear it from his own lips, wanted to ask the obvious question, why? "Because this world, the world I'm a part of and that I helped shape, will end tonight. Tomorrow a different world will begin, that different people will shape. And this choice belongs to them. Or more specifically, to Evie as their representative, which would make it a truly revolutionary act, carried out by the people, for the people, rather than just one of individual malice. And she knew that she believed him. On this last evening there was no room for anything else but truth. The truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth. Like there used to be at the Old Bailey, before the judicial system had become corrupted by the political and the whole place had to be blown up, a year ago this night. And now the year had turned, and it was time to destroy the corrupt political system as well. While she'd been thinking all this, she suddenly realized V had turned and exited from the train, almost as if, in handing it over to her, there was no further business between them. Or at least nothing he could bring himself to mention. She hurried after him, calling him back.
"Where are you going?"
she asked, as he turned once more to face her, though she knew he was only pausing briefly before going on his way. "The time has come for me to meet my Maker." She was sure his words implied a double entendre. "And to at last repay him in kind for all that he has done."
"V, wait, please," she called as he began to turn away once more. "You don't have to do it. You could let it go. We could leave here together."
"I can't," he told her. Not brutally, not with any sense of rejection, but just because, in the end, he couldn't.
"I thought about coming back so many times."
She understood what he meant completely, but still wished it didn't have to be so.
"But I always knew that no matter what happened, no matter what I said or did, this moment would come, and that it didn't need to be any sadder than it already is."
And with that she stepped up to him, and at last, as she'd wanted to before, and as fully as she could, she kissed the frozen lips of his mask. And though he bowed his head to meet her lips, all emotion remained buried behind the mask's facade, behind his overwhelming purpose. "Goodbye," was all he said, all there really was to say. Then he turned and rushed away into a lightless tunnel, cloak billowing behind him, and she could only watch as all trace of him was swallowed by the darkness. Perhaps, she thought, forever. This book is continued on Disc 8.